Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 24th, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon is Lee Roy Essenminger, Prison Congregations of America. Let's listen in.
Roy Essenminger from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I have a unique congregation in the fact that it is inside of a South Dakota state penitentiary. And this session will acquaint you with an organization called Prison Congregations of America. And we are at 4:15 going to be seeing a video, and so we have to kind of watch the time so that we will have time enough for that. On the board behind me, I have two Bible verses. One is from Matthew 25, verse 36, I was in prison and you came to me. And Hebrews 13:3, remember those in prison as though you were in prison with them. And could we take just a few moments and ask the question, how is your congregation back home doing this? How's it doing then?
Yes. We do have a part of the social ministry.
Part of your social ministry program.
They encourage people to join the effort to go out and talk with people and pray and so forth. Bible study.
Okay. Any other congregations involved in prison ministry?
Ours is too.
How so? How is your congregation involved?
Well, they just go to the prison every day and preach to the prisoners.
But
it's just a local.
Yeah. Well, in Matthew 25, it says, I was hungry and you fed me. Okay. Now, historically, what has been the church's response to that? How have we responded to that?
Our church has a chair cupboard.
Pardon me?
Our church has a chair cupboard.
Okay. C-U-R-E?
C-H-E-O.
Oh, care cupboard?
Cheer.
Oh, cheer cupboard. Cheer cupboard, okay.
It's part of the the citywide distribution effort.
Any other ways in which your congregation or your synod or your church body has responded to, I was hungry and you fed me? Well, in our ELCA we have what we call the hunger appeal, right? And at Halloween, what do your kids do?
UNICEF
is another effort at I was hungry and you fed me. I was a refugee and you gave me a home. How is your congregation, your church, your synod, your denomination responded to that?
My church has a teen shelter one night a week. That's rotated with other churches in the area.
Okay, teen shelter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In our area, we have LSA Refugee Resettlement. Congregations will be given a certain refugee family to take care of, to find housing for, to find employment. Right now, Orpha, our congregation is involved with a family from?
Sudan.
Any of your other congregations involved in refugee resettlement? Anything like that?
We have been.
Two other ELCA churches that I've belonged to, one in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and one in Idaho Falls, brought family, or continued to bring families in and supply for them.
I was a pastor for 12 and a half years in a church near Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and we resettled refugees from Vietnam and Cambodia. And it was a very enriching experience for us. Trying at times because of the language barrier and some of the cultural differences, but our church responded in that way. I was naked and you clothed me. How's your congregation responded to that?
Lutheran World Relief.
Lutheran World Relief. LWF. LWRM. Yes.
We give away clothes.
Okay, you have a clothing drive.
Yeah, it's called a clothing closet. We give away clothes for 2 hours clothes. Every Wednesday morning.
Clothing. A variety of congregations in our synod, the women have quilts. They make quilts. In fact, these were made by some ladies' organization in some of our Lutheran churches. They're sent off overseas. They're boxed up, crated, sent off to Africa or some other place. And so we have this whole big effort, at least in our synod,
of
making quilts.
We have the same difference, black and women. Probably several others.
Yeah.
Several. Each year there are several hundred.
Sure. Okay, and how has your church responded to this? I was sick and you visited me. Has this gone around over here?
No.
Okay. Well, I worked as a resident chaplain in one of the largest hospitals in our country. It was called Lutheran General in Park Ridge, Illinois. The church saw fit to respond to the needs of the sick. And so we have Lutheran hospitals, not only Lutheran, but other denominational hospitals. Maybe you have in your congregation a team that will go and visit those who are sick. You have a prayer chain in your congregation, probably. So we have all kinds of efforts dealing with the sick. We have visitation. We have hospitals. As far as people needing clothing, we have the Lutheran World Relief. We have the clothing drive. People make quilts. I was a refugee. You gave me a home. Refugee resettlement. You have places for young people who don't have a home. I was hungry, you fed me, hunger appeal and so on. But generally speaking, this is what we call the forgotten fifth. The forgotten fifth, which is, I was in prison and you visited me. Many congregations are very faithful in doing these four, becoming involved in those four, but we have lacked the ways in which we can respond to I was in prison and you visited me. And now we have developed what we call Prison Congregations of America, a way in which your congregation out here can be involved within a prison congregation on the inside. It's called a Prison Congregations of America. I'd like to have you take this sheet here, coming to your state. And I'd like to have you, there are three paragraphs there. Someone each take turns reading one of those paragraphs, please?
I'll read one.
Okay, fine. You read the first one.
Under what is prison?
What is Prison Congregations of America?
An organization dedicated to establishing mainline congregations in the prison systems of every state in the United States.
A ministry formed by the vision of pastors, prison officials, ex-offenders, family members, and concerned citizens from varied denominations.
Okay, last paragraph.
A concept which has proven worth and viability is evidenced by existing prison congregations in Maryland, South Dakota, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Iowa, Nebraska, and Rhode Island.
Okay, over on the third column there, you'll notice what prison congregations are in place at this time. And then would you take that sheet that shows the red dots, please? What was is the way that this organization started with a congregation, my congregation in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and two congregations in Jessup, Maryland, and one in the men's prison and one in the women's prison. To date, you'll notice the list over here on the third column here, and they're not all Lutheran, as you'll notice. The community of St. Dismas is Lutheran, and that's in Jessup, Maryland, started in 1984. St. Dismas of South Dakota, that's where I am presently pastor, and then also in another unit that South Dakota has at Springfield, South Dakota, that was in 1990. There's an Episcopal St. Dismas in Greater Ford, Pennsylvania, 1991. St. Dismas, which is a Catholic congregation in Smyrna, Delaware. American Baptist Congregation Church of Hope in Pierre, South Dakota. That's a women's congregation that just started in 1997. And then two congregations in Fort Dodge, Iowa, Church of the Damascus Road in 1997. Lincoln, Nebraska started in 1997. We had three congregations that we were able to start in 1997, and now Church of God's Promise, which is an ecumenical congregation, Providence, Rhode Island. What they are going to be doing in that congregation is when one pastor leaves that's been there of one denomination, they'll select a pastor from another denomination to be a part of that. And this fall, there will be number nine, starting in a women's prison in Colorado. Now, let's take a look at why a prison congregation. What is the idea behind it? What is that which drives it? Why should we have it? And again, if you could each take a paragraph, I'd appreciate it, please. Someone take the first paragraph.
Okay. It provides a means for Christians to visit the imprisoned. Every week, 5 to 15 persons from a neighboring congregation comes to worship and fellowship with the inmate members.
Yeah. At our worship service in Sioux Falls, every week, I'm allowed to bring in 12 people from one of these partner congregations. And these people in South Dakota have become so involved here that in terms of a sign-up, reserving a Thursday evening when they come in, we are all full through the rest of this year, on up through April of next year, and we have two signed up for the year 2001. It seems that once the congregation has come, 12 people from here has come to this something that they just kind of get captivated by it. And not only does the congregation get captivated by it, but these men inside the prison look forward every week to being a part of that. Okay.
Why the limit of 12?
It varies with the prison. In the women's prison out in Pierre, the warden will only allow five outsiders to come in. I'm allowed 12. However, if I make advance arrangements and then at St. Dismas' expense provide for another staff member to escort anyone above the number 12, then we can have more than that. We've had, like the American Legion Choir come in, and that's been about 30 people, so I've had to have two extra staff people at St. Dismas' expense spend their time, because with every 12 in our institution, you have to have a staff person. Yeah, it varies from prison to prison. And in our prison, we have to have 2 weeks of advance notice. if you wanted to come, say, in the end of September, 2 weeks prior to your visit, we'd have to have all of your paperwork submitted. It's just background checks and things like that, if you've paid your income tax, I suppose, or something, I don't know. Paragraph number two.
It attracts new recruits to prison ministry. The congregation attracts hundreds of visitors per year. For 95%+, this is their first experience in prison ministry.
Yes. For many people, they've never had the opportunity before to respond to, I was in prison and you visited me. But this gives them an opportunity to be a part of that and to remember those who are in prison. In the almost 10 years that I've been there, we've had over 7,000 people come in to our worship service. A chaplaincy model will not do this. A chaplaincy model is pretty much a one-person show. But with the congregational model, inviting people every week to come in, it has helped change attitudes that people have about prison inmates, and it has provided a way for these prison inmates to become acquainted with a congregation out there who is saying, when you get out, we want you to be a part of our church because we know that you are part of St. Dismas. Okay, paragraph number three.
I'll read it. A bridge of emotional and spiritual support is developed with the outside church. The inmates experience membership in a large community of faith. Bridges are built rather than walls.
Okay. Yeah. And it's really, really pleasing and gratifying to watch the kind of interaction that takes place between these people on the outside who've often been told by the media that there's monsters inside that prison. They're animals. They're portrayed as being very negative people, but people who come into our worship service do a 180-degree turn when they see that these are just very pleasant-looking young people who got caught up into something that they didn't mean to get caught up in. Okay, paragraph number four. Paragraph four.
It gives ownership to inmates, creating growth and responsibility, leadership, development, and cooperation. The elected inmate council makes programmatic decisions, as does any church council.
Okay. We do not teach inmates, at least in South Dakota, how to be responsible. We teach them how to be dependent. They are told what to do, where to go, when they can do it. But having a congregation allows them to assume positions of leadership. They take ownership. This is ours. We want it to succeed. They work hard at it. And in addition to that, it creates a sense of belonging that you don't have created in a chaplaincy model. There are guys who come and they begin to care for one another. And one of the most moving experiences we have in our worship service is when a guy is leaving the prison, either on parole or because he's done his time. We call it, he's flatting out. We have a sending off service, blessing him as he leaves. He's sensed that he belongs here. He's saying goodbye to his friends. We're saying goodbye to him. And Godspeed on his future. Okay, next paragraph.
It provides interpretation of some of the complex criminal justice issues to the members of the sponsoring denomination.
Many of these supporting congregations, as we call them out here, partner congregations, they come in, they listen to some of the issues that these men are telling them about. They become aware of some of the injustice that is in our judicial systems. They become aware of some of the lack of rehabilitation efforts that are in our, with the way our state looks at criminal justice issues. And so many of these people, in addition to supporting the prison congregation, at least in South Dakota, have become involved in a national organization called CURE, Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, emphasizing how important it is to provide rehabilitation and educational opportunities for inmates. These people would have never been involved in issues like that if they hadn't first become involved in the congregation. And then finally, the last paragraph.
It has stability and longevity typical of any congregation. The congregation's strength is derived from a community of faith, not from one or two key people.
Yeah. St. Dismas now is such a part of these congregations out here that they are going to take responsibility for its future. And these congregations out here now, they see this, the prison congregation, as an extension of their ministry. And they see me and the pastor that we have down at Springfield and the woman pastor that we have at the women's prison in Pierre, they see us as their associates in ministry on assignment to these other churches, on assignment to the prison. How is prison congregation supported? One of the ways in which it is supported is that in our synod, we ask welcome groups to send quilts. And these quilts are here on display. They're also for sale. You can see the price here. But there is also a sheet here that tells if you want to order some more for your congregation. There's a website number that you can use. And then I'd like to have you just take quickly a look at Trek 99. A young man in California, a sophomore in college, has taken it upon himself to support PCA with a bicycle trek from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. And what he's doing here is seeking to get $25 per mile, and all of that then will go towards the support of Prison Congregations of America. And just before we came out here, he had made it as far as our city, Sioux Falls, and he came up one Monday evening to talk to the men about some of his experiences riding his bicycle across South Dakota. If you want to help in that endeavor, you're certainly welcome. But also then, you'll also notice here on the back, if you need more information about PCA, this is the director, Pastor Ed Nesselhoff. We're ready to show the film now. Okay. And if you are interested in knowing how to set up a congregation, here are books that will tell you. They're a cost of $3, but we would hope that these books could go out and your congregation would say, hey, let's band together with some other congregations in our area. We've got a prison close by. Let's start up a congregation to minister to these people, because most of these guys are going to get out of prison. And what kind of attitude do you want them to have when they are out? Now, the video that you're going to see is a prison congregation in action. And then after that, we'll stop and ask some questions. Right at the beginning of this video, you'll notice a man being chained up, and he happens to be the president of the congregation. Apparently, he's being taken out maybe for a medical exam or something. And whenever that happens, they have to put a belly chain around him and a chain between their legs and so on, and an orange jumpsuit. But he's the president of the Jessup, Maryland congregation, and a very fine Christian man.
Thank you. in the community very near Jessup all my life. I grew up there, within 2 miles of those big giant prisons. And my church was within, you know, a couple miles of there. And yet, we never, any of us in the church, had set foot inside these prisons or knew anyone that had ever been in them. They were them, and then it was us. Then came a situation in my life where a person that I loved very dearly was convicted of drunk driving and was imprisoned for that. And that was just an astronomical shattering experience to my personal view of the world, because them was now us.
When the head counselor came to my office, Shirley Fons, and she said, what do you think about the idea of creating within the walls a congregation? And I said, that is a terrific idea, because immediately I was thinking about what all could be accomplished through such a creation. Within our prison systems, we do not think in terms of inmates being taught to take responsibility. They are told when to go here and when to go there and so forth and so on.
Marianna Burt has been at the forefront of criminal justice issues for 17 years. Politically, her keen insight and experience with the penal system guided officials of the American Lutheran Church through the administrative maze of the Maryland Department of Corrections. Prophetically, her concept of inmate responsibility inspired their vision.
I think that you can never do anything for people, that you have to do it with people, and that this idea of having the congregation within the walls is such an attempt. The inmates are involved. They have a part to play. They have a responsibility to take.
Officials of the Maryland Department of Corrections agreed, and in 1984, formal approval was granted for the formation of a congregation of the American Lutheran Church within the prison system. The community of St. Dismas was about to be born, and from the prairies of South Dakota, Pastor Ed Nesselhoff was called to develop the congregation. Intentionally, he had absolutely no experience with prison ministry.
When I first started here, a classification officer said she would go through the files of the 400 women here and bring me a list of the names who had put Lutheran as their denomination. An hour later, she brought me three names. So I looked up Lutheran number one, and I said, I'm here to start a Lutheran congregation. I'm a Lutheran pastor. She said, that sounds great, but I'm going home Monday. I couldn't get to Lutheran number two because she was on segregated law. And Lutheran number three thought it was a grand idea, so we started.
That was at MCIW, the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women. Less than a mile away, at MCIJ, the men's prison, a second Lutheran inmate was found. A graduate of Augustana Academy in South Dakota, his relatives include a 19th century president of the North Carolina Lutheran Synod. Douglas Erie has spent the past 14 years in prison. During that time, he has earned 5 college degrees and has served as a jailhouse lawyer to inmates and staff alike. It was he who wrote the articles of incorporation for the congregation, and he was chosen to serve as president of the church council of the men's prison. MCIW had already elected its church council and president, and inmates who at the most receive $1.50 a day in wages took on the responsibilities of stewardship by making crafts which were offered for sale at local congregations. St. Dismas, on paper, was rapidly becoming St. Dismas in people. It was a congregation like any other congregation, and a congregation different from any other congregation Ed Nesselhoff had ever encountered.
I'm not sure what I expected to find when I came to start a prison congregation. I'd never been around prisons to speak of. I had visited one once in a visiting room. I wasn't here very long, and I could see that the whole name of the game is control and confinement, isolate people, and something about that. I don't know, it just sort of hurt.
And you're around a lot of people here, whether you want to be or not. And it's not really life. You don't hear babies here. You don't hear. And there's a lot of things like that you don't hear. That you miss.
Giving down there is not a word. Giving is, you just don't do it. It's the more you give, the more they take. The people down there have been there for a long time. Some of them have been there 10 times. And they are very, very wise as far as working the system for themselves. And it hurts the people that are not used to that type of situation, that are not that kind of person to use another one. And they end up being the one without anything because these people steal from them, hurt them, tell the officers they're doing things they shouldn't be doing, getting them in trouble. And you look around, you're like, people don't do this. People really don't treat people like this, do they? But they do. And you learn very quickly that people are very cruel.
And it was just a terrible feeling of just coming to like a, almost like a hell on earth. It was, you know, I didn't want to be around anybody, and it was just, you know, the doors clanging, and, you know, they're telling me what to do everywhere, and take stripping, searching you, and just really, they really did take what literally got left, they take that, you know. And I don't think it's so much a deliberate thing. I think the system is just like that. It just does that. I mean, even if you had the most humane people running it, I mean, this type of security things, yeah, they have, just, you know, they just, they happen. It just really destroys what little bit of maybe dignity or things you might have left.
Problems affecting inmates within our correctional systems are complex and at times overwhelming. The men's facility at MCIJ, for instance, was built to house 500 inmates. Its present population is 973 inmates, an overload of nearly 90%. That inevitably creates tensions and inhibits individual attention.
We do have in the population approximately 9 lifers, people doing life that have progressed through the system, and they're here for all types of crimes, murder, burglaries, assaults, violations of probations, and most of them are repeat offenders. Those people have repeat offenders. When I talk about the recidivism rate, where it means how many times a person, once a person goes out, his likelihood of returning, and in the state of Maryland, it's something around 65%.
An overcrowded community where 65% of the people have been in prison before. A community where 80% of the inhabitants do not have a high school diploma, and 50% of them have a reading ability of 5th grade or below. A community where 70% of the residents were sexually abused as children. Individuals who were themselves victimized before they became victimizers of society. It is to this pained and fragmented community that St. Dismas sought to bring healing and reconciliation.
You know, it was really a beautiful experience because I never had anybody really care for me. I never had anybody, you know, not just ridiculing when I made mistakes or riot me or all that stuff, you know. Ed wasn't like that. Ed was, you know, he just made you feel comfortable. He made you feel like, you know, it's okay if you make a mistake or something, just, you know, try. And that's why I really stuck with the St. Dismas community, because, you know, I mean, coming from the pits, you know, you don't need somebody just to kick you every time you make a mistake, because, you know, we're all gonna make mistakes. And I just felt really a lot of brotherhood and a lot of concern for people. And, you know, I just kept coming back. And so now, you know, I was fortunate, I was elected to the council there. And without St. Dismas, you know, I mean, I'm having a lot of troubles anyway, because I got in a lot of trouble in the past, and nobody wants to believe that you've changed. And, you know, they think it's all a scam or something. And it's not, you know, and I don't have to prove that to Ed, you know, even though I still try to do that, and I don't want everybody to believe that, you know, hey, I'm leaving that behind me. I don't get that judgmental stuff, and I really feel comfortable with St. Dismas. So that's why I'm involved.
Terrence told me once that he wasn't badgered or scared into the kingdom of God, but that he became a Christian because white couple would come to visit him and hug him each week in a segregated area.
Church in which she went to, so I started going there. It was something that I've never felt before in my life. Because when you come from the world in which I lived and all the things that I had to do in my life, then the feeling that I got the night that I was baptized was a feeling that I'll never forget.
In here, I think you learn not to expose a lot of real feelings. Because if it's negative feelings, then, you know, you're leaving yourself open for a fight. If it's directed at a guard, you're leaving yourself open for disciplinary action. And if it's a positive feeling, it's kind of a weakness, and it's not something that you want to show. So everything gets to be real shallow and surfaced. And you could kind of let that down on Saturday night for the hour in the Fellowship of St. Dismas. I learned a lot as far as being able to communicate and love people and care about people, you know, within the confines of these gates and these walls that's around this prison, there was still love and freedom and caring for that hour.
Love, freedom, and caring for that 1 hour of worship. That 1 hour of worship quickly became 2 hours on Friday evenings for the men of MCIJ and on Saturday evenings for the women of MCIW. An hour of worship followed by something for which most inmates hungered, simply to sit and talk with visitors from Lutheran congregations on the outside. In 1986, over 1,100 visitors representing 40 area congregations and 15 out-of-state congregations across the nation worshipped at the Tuesday Dismas services. That linkage with outside congregations not only became absolutely essential to the survival of St. Dismas as a congregation, but to the survival of its members, both in and out of prison.
A lot of these guys have never been paid attention to their entire lives. They know nothing of what love means. And one of the issues is that, you know, the Bible talks about love. Without love, you have nothing. And the volunteers, I think, show a degree of love that has never been shown to these people for an interest. And that in itself has been a key to changing people's lives in these penal institutions.
The importance of the outside visitors from the other congregations, from our support congregations, I can't tell you the value of it. It's the thing that I think keeps most of these guys going back to church, just to have input from the outside world.
There was such a spirit that you could feel. We would sit through the service, we would enjoy ourselves, we were allowed to touch, we were allowed to hug. And the best part was, there was somebody there from the outside. There was a congregation there that was going to share an hour or so with us. Somebody that would come up and say, I'm so glad I got to meet you. Got to meet me? I mean, I have a record. I'm a criminal. Not to them. I'm an individual. I'm a human being. They were giving me self-respect. As I continued into this, my self-respect for myself grew. I grew. I learned to be able to love. I learned to share.
I kick my teeth out of my mouth. Done a lot of horrible things. So finally he did. He went to jail. He went to jail when my son was a year old. My son now is 18. So time went on and I started losing my home. I had to go back to my mother. And I would go back to her. And she made me feel really unwanted. She would throw slurs like, get out my house, or I can't deal with this, or I don't want this one here, or it's getting to be too much. I'm grown. I had no business there anyway, but I felt like this is my mother, and if I ever needed any support, I would always have a home. But it wasn't like that. I had 3 court charges because I was out there stealing and trying to make it with 4 kids in a house. Gas and the telephone, so I went crazy. I got a drug habit, I got kids, and I got a house. And I couldn't do it all by myself. So you can sort of like say, I just do my life and let it go either way. Either I live, either they send me to jail or I die. I think I asked for it.
And I think he's saying that God is most present in those worst of situations because that's the way God is. He goes to where the hurt is the greatest. And he's the one, remember, who will leave the 99 and go after just one who is dumb enough to walk off and get lost and fall in a crack in the canyon.
Come from out of town, you know, just to come down here to see us women. And, you know, and I feel like if they go to that extent, to come from California, Louisiana, you know, and we have had them there, you know, and we must have meant something to them, you know. And they said they're going to keep coming back, you know. And they said, I hope to see you someday in one of the congregations. And it made me feel real good. It made me feel like I've been accepted, you know. And not just by my immediate family, but my family and the congregation, you know.
It's very important for the inmates to know that people on the outside care about them. So for the people from the church to come in and let them know that they are loved and that they are still people, that they still have identities. I was walking out with very little to go to besides my daughter. I felt with the church that I had a family to get to. And it made such a difference. It made me take those steps a little faster. It made those steps more important to me and much easier to get to.
The residents in this place are just like the rest of us. We are all looking for hope, all searching for love. We found it here. The music helped, the words helped, but sitting next to people and talking to people was a thing. I would say heart to heart was the most meaningful experience for me in this whole thing. We came on a cold night. Someone in church said to me, what will you talk to those people about? Well, those people are us. We are all the same.
If we do not believe as correctional professionals that inmates can be returned to the community to maintain a lawful lifestyle and successfully reintegrate themselves into the community, who else do we expect to believe that? And the community of St. Dismas for us has been a marvelous way to introduce them back into the community, but with a very supportive structure. And quite frankly, for a lot of adult female offenders, without that structure to go to lean on, their likelihood of successful reentry lawfully into the community in the long run is diminished. And it doesn't mean that every woman who's joined the community of St. Dismas has left here and been a success. But we have women who have, while they were here and were part of the community, you could see that they truly began to believe that somebody was going to be there for them when they left here.
They do get a chance to put their life back together in a normal way, and they don't have to, you know, wait on somebody to unlock the gate for them, and they don't have to be told to do this and do that, but they can go back to a kind of a normal life, and hopefully to a better style of life. So that really keeps me going. We are probably the only congregation in the nation who just loves to lose members.
I miss a lot of the members down there, but not enough to go back to Jessup, you know. I think Jessup was my last stop.
And I honestly believe that I'm gonna make it, because you see, when I leave, I'm not leaving alone.
Jesus, remember me. Jesus,
showing that.
Yeah. Sorry about the short recording.
Will it be fixed by tonight? I'm going to be showing Dead Man Walking here tonight after Vespers. You had a question or comment?
Yeah. I was wondering how you got around or through or under all the stuff. I mean, I saw stuff there that I couldn't believe. I mean, they had loaves of bread. I mean, you didn't bring those bread loaves in, did you? They made them there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in
prison
that
kitchen.
Film.
From the prison kitchen.
Right.
Yeah.
And the flowers and the communion cups, all the stuff that...
it varies from prison to prison. Yeah.
I can tell you right now, in Walla Walla, Washington, you would walk in there with shoulder pads on your clothes. I couldn't walk in there dressed the way I am right now. This blouse is too big. They take off my shoulder pads. I couldn't wear... they search you.
Yeah. Prison,
they even look at your dentures.
Prisons vary. Some are, just unreal.
Do they go through all that for everybody, all these 12 people that you take with you? What do they do?
Well, we send out ahead of time a list of what is permitted and what is not permitted. What behaviors are allowed, what things they can bring in. At the top of the list, nothing in, nothing out. And it's amazing how the prison keeps track of that. Last spring, I think it was, or maybe it was last fall, my wife and our music director were given little keychains. They were miniature moccasins, Indian moccasins. And the next day, the associate warden called me aside and said, "Say, we had some stuff leave the prison last night. You know that that isn't..." How they found out, I do not know. And so I had to, but that's been the only time that we've gotten into any discussion with prison officials, because we have to be so careful about that. And there's a dress code that is permitted. And we had a young man come all the way from Custer, South Dakota, which is about 400 miles from the prison, to come in. He had shorts. There's no way they could get in. Okay, so what did we do? I went back to where the men, it's kind of an area where they can get their own blue jeans, and I asked the officer if I could have a pair of blue jeans for this young man. But and the bread, we use communion wafers, and we use, I hope that the Lord will forgive us, but we mix up grape Kool-Aid because we're not allowed to bring in any glassware, anything like that. Our communion cups are either the throwaway paper ones or the throwaway plastic ones. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
What kind of follow-up program do you have for these people when they're discharged from prison?
Yeah, well, what we try to do, and we're not very successful in that, and what we are engaged in presently now is an aftercare ministry program. We're just getting that developed. But what we hope to do and what we have done is, up until this point, we haven't been privy to who gets out. And when. And so it's been very difficult to set the machinery in motion for a congregation out there to accept this guy. But now we are. And so I think it'll be easier for us to set up some type of follow-up program. I do have, within the Sioux Falls city, I keep in contact with about a dozen of these guys. I take one of them to AA on Friday nights, and then I have a couple of other guys who come and help me on Saturdays and things like that.
Well, do any of them seek out the congregation after they leave the
prison? Oh yes, yes, and we have several people who have are members of congregations in Sioux Falls who make it a point of meeting the man at the gate and saying, we want you to come and be a part of our congregation. And because they have come in on Thursday night, they've gotten acquainted with these guys that are going to be getting out and say, we'll be there for you, our church is waiting for you.
Will you be talking in future presentations about how you address the emotional and spiritual needs of these people aside from the service?
Well, what I do, I'm there every day. This is my congregation, and I'm there every day, and the men who want to see me put in requests, and I call them up to my office. And we do that. We also have, in addition to our worship service, Bible studies, a variety of Bible study offerings. I offer confirmation classes, pre-baptism classes. It's just like a regular congregation that we have there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Do you have any rapport with other prison ministries?
Yes. In our prison, we have a Protestant chaplain who has worship service on Sunday morning. The Roman Catholic priest, who is there part-time, supported by the Sioux Falls Diocese, he has Mass on Saturday evening, but he's there 3 days a week. And then there are other volunteer Bible study people who come in, and we have rapport with them. Our first two religious coordinators were former Navy chaplains. And I understand that a theme for Navy chaplains is, let's see, how does that go again? Cooperation without compromise. That you cooperate with other religious denominations, but you don't have to compromise your own faith stance. And that worked very well. We have a little different situation now with our cultural affairs coordinator, but the chaplains, we have a staff meeting every Wednesday where we pray together, talk over issues that face us all. Yes, sir.
Have you had any dealings with any of the new privately operated prisons?
No, I have not. No, we've tried in Appleton, Minnesota. We were hoping that we could have an entree there, but it didn't work there. We certainly hope that you will consider joining up with some other congregation in your area if you've got a prison there, and developing a prison congregation. I'd like to read you something here. Okay. This is from an inmate, and it goes out as part of the packet that we send to congregations who are thinking of probably starting a prison ministry. I'm sitting here in my cell, searching through my mind in search for new hope and reasons to be grateful. I am serving 15 years. 3 months ago, I saw no light at the end of the tunnel. My life was dull, gray, and dark. Through the kindness and courage that the outside church members have to come visit with us here inside the penitentiary, you people have given me new hope. Today, the light at the end of the tunnel is so bright, I almost had to buy a welder's mask just to continue my journey to the end of the tunnel, as I am now able to hold up my head. You see, one of the many fears of us inmates is wearing a tattoo across our fair forehead that reads convict when we are released from prison, and then not being accepted back into society. But the outsiders who come here to visit with us gave me a new outlook on life upon my release. You people have taught me that there really are decent people in this world who care about us inmates, and that I do have a place in society. You outsiders have such a special place here in our church inside of the prison. Thank you for giving me this new hope. Well, thank you folks very much for being a part of today. Tonight, in this room, we will see the movie Dead Man Walking. That's a phrase that prisons use when a man who is on death row is let out for recreation or is going from one place to another, maybe to the doctor or something. It comes over the loudspeaker, Dead Men Walking. And so this is a movie about a condemned individual. That will be shown in here tonight after Vespers. Tomorrow's session that I will lead is about, we call it WAIT, W-A-I-T, We Are Inmates Too, the unseen inmates, those who are locked into prison in a sense because they have a loved one in prison, the families, the children of those inmates. So I'd like to invite you back tomorrow. So thank you. If you have not signed our sheet here today and your address, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And if any of you are, I'd like to have you ladies look at these quilts and so on. So.